This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 21st, 2021. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 178, the first of spring 2021. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, the Is It Just Me commentary. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and the big deal feature, remembering the late Ian Waddell with former BC Premier Glenn Clark, and a mystery in the Meng Wanzhou court files. I ask China experts Peter Dalene and Margaret McQuaig Johnston about an ominous threat mentioned in an RCMP report from December 2018. But first, is it just me? Is it just me, or does something really smell in North Vancouver? And how much will people all around the Lower Mainland end up paying for it? On March the 12th, Metro Vancouver finally revealed that the North Shore Wastewater Treatment Plant project, being built by Acciona, would cost $1.058 billion and take until 2024 to be built. It was originally announced in 2017 as a $525 million project that should have been completed by 2020. You can read all about it on thebreaker.news. It's under the headline, Billion Dollar Metro Vancouver Sewage Plant Project Has the Overruns. On March 17th, the Federal Liberal Infrastructure Minister, Catherine McKenna, and Environment Minister, Jonathan Wilkinson, who represents North Vancouver, joined with BC Transportation Minister, Rob Fleming, and Junior Infrastructure Minister, Bowen Ma of North Vancouver. They were on a Zoom news conference to announce more transit funding. But I took the opportunity to ask them about the troubled sewage plant and its rather smelly finances.
I've got a question about a federally, provincially funded mega project that is in MP Wilkinson and MLA Ma's ridings. Last week, Metro Vancouver announced that the North Shore Wastewater Treatment Plant has been delayed to 2024 and that the new budget will be $1.058 billion. It was supposed to be finished by 2020 and cost half the price. The chair of Metro Vancouver, Sav Dhaliwal, told me that the federal and BC governments are not putting any more money into the project right now. They've been asked for more funding. Are the federal and provincial governments looking at funding increases for next year to bring this up, especially since there's a greater tax burden being faced by Metro Vancouver residents?
We seem to have lost Minister McKenna, so if I can ask Minister Wilkinson to jump in on that.
Well, this is all relatively recent news, as you know, Bob. The budget, the revised budget, was just announced last week, and I have not yet had a chance to have a conversation with Metro regarding what their thoughts are in terms of what they would like to see from the federal and provincial government. I'm certainly happy to engage that conversation, but as you know, the federal government has already committed very substantial funding to this project, and it's an important project from an environmental perspective that needs to be completed. But obviously there is concern with respect to the increases in the overall capital that's required to get this done.
Bob, did you have a follow-up?
Yes. Also about the North Shore Wastewater Treatment Plant, the design build finance contractor is Acciona. And this is the same company that's working on the Site C dam. That's doubled in price to $16 billion, and that's been delayed as well. Acciona has contracts for the new Patella Bridge, as well as the Broadway subway. What do you say to taxpayers who are worried about waste and corruption? They're worried about waiting longer and paying more for projects like this, especially involving Acciona, which is a company that looks like it's quite spread thin. What do you say to taxpayers about what's going on with all these projects?
Sorry, I'm just rejoining. So I had a bit of a challenge there. I don't know if there was a previous question that another minister followed up. My computer just, I don't know, unexpectedly shut down.
There was an initial question just about the increase in costs of the North Vancouver Wastewater Treatment Plant and whether the federal and provincial government were going to be working to respond to that. That I think we've kind of dealt with, but the follow-up question is just respecting the contractor that's been hired by Metro, as well as, I guess, for Site C and a couple of other projects. I don't know if the provincial folks want to respond to that.
Thank you very much. This is Bob. Can you hear me? It's Minister Fleming.
Yes, I can.
Minister Fleming. Yeah. So What I would say is that on the Patella Bridge replacement, we have a partnership between Acciona and another firm. So it's a consortium there. We're very, very pleased that that project is underway now with In River work having begun. We have a very, very strong on the ground management team there through the TI Corp. I think it would be fair to say that there are many lessons learned from the Site C Dam project. I don't think that that there's very many similarities in terms of the technical and engineering type of work in the project, but in terms of oversight and project management on both Broadway Subway and on the Patella Bridge replacement, we have a very, very strong team in place. We're happy with the work that's begun, and we're very pleased that both of those projects are underway since the turning of the calendar year. These will not just create hundreds or thousands of jobs, but tens of thousands of direct and indirect jobs into the Metro Vancouver regional economy.
Thank you very much. That is all the questions we have today.
That got me thinking. Did Minister McKenna really have a technical problem? And what about those answers that were given? I think that they did not pass the smell test. What do you think? Email bob@thebreaker.news.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In Alaska public media, global powers face off in Anchorage. Alaskans barely notice. At the Hotel Captain Cook, business was mostly as usual, with a DoorDash delivery driver delivering a McDonald's order and a hotel guest sauntering the other direction in workout clothes. When President Barack Obama visited Anchorage in 2015, he stayed at the same hotel. The Secret Service erected a beefy security perimeter with concrete roadblocks and sand-filled trucks. But none of that for U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan on March 18th. Blinken and Chinese Communist Party counterparts sparred verbally. Blinken noted China's cyber attacks and crackdowns on ethnic minorities. One of China's top diplomats responded with his own lecture about human rights in America, including the Black Lives Matter movement. In Apple Daily, history with Chinese Communist Party characteristics. All the people go back to school. The Chinese Communist Party has announced a population-wide reading drive for 2021, to coincide with the party's centennial. According to the state-owned Xinhua news agency, the public must learn about the, quote, new Xi Jinping-era socialism with Chinese characteristics, end quote, so as to, quote, cultivate their roots and forge their souls, end quote, the notice read. In the New Zealand Herald, America's Cup partygoers slammed for cultural appropriation in mock haka video. During celebrations of New Zealand's America's Cup victory aboard a $21 million yacht, white New Zealanders were caught on video performing the haka, the traditional Maori dance. The incident was not the first to spark social media outrage during the America's Cup. Ollie Wall, the son of real estate tycoon Graham Wall, dressed up as the QAnon shaman from the Capitol Hill riot. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Yes.
News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Eugene Register Guard, stories the Register Guard reported made possible by public records in honor of Sunshine Week. From policing to education to college sports, some headline examples of how one Oregon newspaper got the goods for its readers and put public officials under scrutiny via freedom of information. Springfield school leaders stuck to reopening plan despite parents and teachers pleading to wait. Two men say Springfield police use excessive force will get $150,000 combined in settlement. Oregon Ducks finalize Marcel Yates' contract, extend four other football assistants. Concerns from teachers, parents in Oak Ridge remain after investigation into superintendent. And Springfield paid former officer Ryan Stone and attorneys $250,000 to settle a lawsuit in employment. From the Associated Press, Washington State Senator Doug Erickson has missed many votes, some while in El Salvador. Whatcom County Republican Erickson has missed more votes than any other state lawmaker this year, with some of his absences from the current legislative action occurring while he was observing elections in El Salvador. He told the Bellingham Herald newspaper that his trip was separate from his work to lobby for Cambodia. Erickson registered as a foreign agent in 2019. Washington state senators are paid $57,000 a year plus per diems. In Czech news, they'll be sadly missed. Friends identify victims in Gabriela Island construction site accident. Chris Straw and Mark Dore, both former CBC employees, died in a Gabriela Island construction accident. They were helping pour the foundation with bedrock ready mix of Nanaimo for a home when a concrete pump truck boom broke and fell on them on March 16th. They were both pronounced dead at the scene, despite a massive effort by first responders. WorkSafe BC and the coroner are investigating. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Another Hmong and Two Michaels mystery. Michael Spavor was tried in secret on March 19th in Dandong, China. Fellow Canadian prisoner Michael Kovrig goes on trial March 22nd. China accuses the two Michaels of spying. But in the West, they're known as hostages who were taken in retaliation for Canada's arrest of Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou in 2018. The United States wants to try Meng on fraud charges. Her extradition case continues in BC Supreme Court. In the court file, the Breaker.News found an RCMP officer's report from December 2018 that includes this ominous line, and I quote, "Complainant reported online threats that if Meng was not released, two Canadians would die," end quote. It raises the question, could Canada have acted faster to warn Canadians in China about their safety? You can read more on the story in the Breaker.News under this headline, "Canadian government officials silent about ominous threat after Meng's arrest." I reached out to two China experts to get their point of view on this police report and the threat. First, Swedish human rights activist Peter Dahlin, who was jailed for 3 weeks in early 2016 in China. He is the driving force behind Safeguard Defenders.
Obviously, one cannot know for sure, but the refusal to deny it would, of course, indicate that there is something more to it than just some, you know, online prank. Because if they had dismissed it, they would most likely just say so out loud. That's pretty typical government behavior, after all. So the failure to not say that, you know, we rule this out is very indicative that there's something more to it, for sure. But then again, I mean, there's a lot of threats all the time from Chinese netizens, from the so-called Wuma army, etc. So the fact that some kind of death threat would be made, that in itself is not that special. But the fact that they are not denying it or saying that they ruled it out, that of course makes it a lot more interesting, for sure.
Margaret McQuaid-Johnston is a former assistant deputy minister in the Government of Canada and is a former member of the Canada-China Joint Committee on Science and Technology. She is now a senior fellow at the University of Ottawa and University of Alberta.
I think these are questions that will come out in court, and that's the right place for them. They're questions that lawyers on both sides will be wanting to consider as they're going through this process.
And certainly,
there's a lot in this case that throws the whole issue of Meng into question with the way that China has behaved, and so I'm sure that we'll hear this in due time, but I think it's interesting that you know there were threats. We'd want to know where they came from in the first instance and who they were made to. Was it somebody who the person thought might be in a position to change the status of her arrest? And of course, we know that two Canadians did not die. And so that threat really perhaps wasn't credible to begin with. You know, maybe this person was just making a loose threat.
Mm-hmm. even though the fate of the two Michaels, their livelihoods were taken away from them. Not their lives, but their livelihoods at very least.
Their lives have been taken away from them for more than 2 years. And, you know, I was a friend of China for 40 years, and I'll never be a friend of China again. I'm just outraged that this would happen to two innocent Canadians.
Those were the voices of Margaret McQuaid Johnston and Peter Deline. Go to thebreaker.news to read the full story. Remembering Ian Waddell. Last week, British Columbia politics lost a character who was respected on both sides of the House, in Ottawa and in Victoria. Retired NDP MP and MLA Ian Waddell died at age 78 on March 15th in Vancouver. Born in Glasgow, the lawyer represented the Tri-Cities and later Vancouver Kingsway during 14 years in Parliament. Later, he was the NDP MLA for Vancouver Fraserview for 5 years. In 2018, Ian Waddell published his memoir called Take the Torch. This is a clip of Waddell in an August 2019 interview on TV Ontario's The Agenda with host Nam Kiwanuka.
Back in the day, you were able, it seems like you were able to affect so much change. Is it possible now to do the same, to have that same kind of power and influence?
Not at all. I say in the book, you have to have a number of, you have to bite some dogs. Mm-hmm. You know, what do they say, like, dog bites man, no story, man bites dog. That's a story. So you gotta grab issues. A good example was what we did in Vancouver, nuclear. You know, when I was younger, I mean, still relevant now, but I don't think people know it so much, was the Cold War and the danger of nuclear war. And we put together, we just called for action. We got some people out. We went to a Pete Seeger concert. We held some signs up saying, hey, we're going to have a rally. 30,000 people showed up. And then we got 60, and then we got 100,000 to walk across the Burrard Street Bridge in Vancouver. And we didn't just, we had a concert, we had music, and we had fun. And we made it fun, and we made it attractive to young people. And they came out. And did we have an influence? I'm not sure, I think we did on the peace movement. Mm-hmm. We went to New York, I talked about, we had 1 million people marching. And it was a movement, you know? And you've seen movements in the past, the green, you know, the environment movement, the peace movement, the gay movement, the women's movement. You know, you have to grab these issues.
Waddell was appointed by BC Premier Glenn Clark to be the tourism and sports minister in 1998. Waddell remained in the position until 2000. He was a key figure in turning film and TV production into a major BC industry. Waddell was also the tourism minister when BC successfully campaigned for the Canadian rights to bid for the 2010 Winter Olympics. BC beat out 1988 host Calgary and Quebec City, a losing bidder, for 2002. I asked former Premier Glenn Clark about Ian Waddell's legacy.
Glenn, where were you when you heard that Ian had passed away?
You know, I got a text from Mo Sahota, believe it or not, who'd found out first in the evening. Yeah, it's funny. I talked to Ian about maybe 3 weeks ago at most. I mean, he was his typical upbeat self. He told me he'd had a heart scare that was a couple of days in December. And so he was all better now, and he was working out and running and skiing, and he was active, and he sounded great. And so it was a real shock to see him pass so fast and so suddenly.
Looking back at the 1990s, when you were premier and you chose him to be in cabinet and chose him to be tourism minister, why did you choose Ian? What did you see in him for that portfolio?
Well, he's almost the perfect description of what you want for a tourism minister. He's a shameless booster of British Columbia. His energy levels were high. He loved promoting BC. He's a good salesperson. He liked going to all the events, you know, all the black tie events and representing British Columbia. Not all politicians, believe it or not, really like that side of politics, but he was perfect for it. And when he got his bit in his teeth, you know, when he really got something, whether it was both the Olympics or the film industry, he really was just relentless, actually annoyingly relentless in pursuing those internally inside the government.
Remember, he, back in the 1990s, was really, really dreaming big, putting out some trial balloons once in a while. I remember one trial balloon was, how about British Columbia bid to bring the Oscars to Vancouver? Really dreamed big. It's been difficult to get the Oscars out of Hollywood. I think they've been in New York recently, but never came to Vancouver, but have had Oscar nominees in British Columbia because of the foundation laid in the 1990s.
Well, as you know, it's a tricky question, right? Tax expenditures. Because at the time we had a pretty decent film industry, but we were lagging partly because other jurisdictions had matched the tax credit system in British Columbia. So, you know, where does it stop and how far along do you move? And Ian did a lot of work to sort of persuade me in particular and the government generally that that there was opportunities in British Columbia in beyond just the film industry, in the animation industry and in video games and other things that we could really look at building a knowledge-based, if you will, creative industry here in British Columbia. And one of our competitive advantages is it's such a spectacular place with a very good education system. And so he persuaded us to proceed, and we did it. And boy, it was good timing because it's really paid off.
Looking back on his work on the Olympics, it became much bigger than anyone ever thought it would be, and transformed the economy for good, bad, and the ugly of Vancouver, for tourism, for trade, for real estate. What was it about his work on the Olympics that you saw was key back in the 1990s?
Well, he really everything into it, as he always did with everything. And in our case, it's a funny story that I don't think I've ever told the story, not a big one, but when we were bidding for the Canadian rights, we weren't the front runner, right? The front runner was Quebec because they had won the rights previously and lost at the IOC. And so they were going for a second shot at it. And Calgary was a little bit of a, Calgary had, they were really late to the party and they were arguing, of course they had all the infrastructure paid for. So they, but they were kind of not half-hearted, but they were a little bit less, I think, keen. So British Columbia was behind, and Ian wanted me to go to Toronto to present on behalf of British Columbia to sort of do the closing speech or one of the big, to try to be a closer on the thing. And I didn't want to go because I was absolutely exhausted. I hadn't seen my family for a while. You know, politics is a tough business that way. My son was quite young. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll arrange to bring your son with you. Your son could come with you. And I'll arrange to get him in to see the Toronto Maple Leafs right into the gardens because he had Arthur Griffiths on side. So he worked on this big elaborate thing to try to compel me to go to the deal. And I'm afraid to say now, because I don't think it looks very good. I should have been so keen to go, but I wasn't at the time. And then when he arranged for my son to come, and it was actually a really nice trip for me and my son as well. We went to the Hockey Hall of Fame, and we got a signed autograph from Matt Sundin and a stick. And we managed to arrange to get into the Toronto Maple Leafs dressing room and all that stuff. And so, and then of course we had the big presentation, which was very, very important to us. And he really went way beyond for me personally so that I could not only go there, but I could be relaxed and supportive and do a good job. And so I think that's how far he went on everything to try to make this happen. So he really, really pulled all the stops. And we, of course, didn't win by very much, the Canadian rights.
Just enough to transform the province in so many ways. Finally, how do you think Ian should be remembered?
That even though he was a New Democrat, he wasn't particularly partisan. He was really, he really just was passionate about the country and about the province and about trying to make a difference. He was really determined to make a difference. And I think he did make a difference. And so, you know, for a lot of people, not just in politics, but in life, you know, if you can leave behind a legacy where you made a difference in people's lives, boy, that's a terrific legacy. And Ian certainly did that.
Well, thanks again for joining us on the Breaker.News podcast, the big deal feature, looking back at the life of Ian Waddell, former member of parliament, former member of the Legislative Assembly, with ex-premier Glenn Clark, now with the Jim Pattison Group.
Thanks, Bob. Nice to talk to you.
That was the voice of Glenn Clark, who was the 31st Premier of British Columbia from 1996 to 1999. He is now President and Chief Operating Officer of the Jim Pattison Group.
Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week, we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to British Columbians with Down syndrome and those who are helping them live better, longer lives. An estimated 45,000 Canadians live with Down syndrome. March 21st is World Down Syndrome Day. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to Bob at thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
So I'm very happy that I'm going to get my Moderna shot today. And I wanted to tell everybody, I think you should get out there and do it too. I even changed one of my songs to fit the occasion. It goes, vaccine, 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 vaccine. I'm begging of you, please don't hesitate. Vaccine, 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 vaccine. Because once you're dead, then that's a bit too late. I know I'm trying to be funny now, but I'm dead serious about the vaccine. I think we all want to get back to normal, whatever that is, and that would be a great shot in the arm, wouldn't it?
Those are the sounds of country music legend and actress Dolly Parton on Twitter. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 21st, 2021. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on March 21st in 1980, U.S. President Jimmy Carter announced American athletes would boycott the Moscow Summer Olympics to protest the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan? Canada announced its boycott a little more than a month later. Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to Bob at thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit TheBreaker.News on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. That's patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. Until next week.